Okay, sorry about the delay there. I have always loved the etymology of words, the meaning behind words, where they originated from. It's been a fascination since I was a child. My surname was Bowyer, and I always remember Dad proudly getting out a copy of the Oxford English Dictionary and showing me that a bowyer was somebody who made longbows, as in bows and arrows. It's kind of related to Bowman and all of those surnames. And it's always fascinated me that the history is carried down through people's names. But way back in the beginning, Hebrew was probably one of the earliest languages around. Well, last Saturday, we were manning the Freedom Fire ministry tent at the Regatta here in Christchurch, Dorset. And I was sketching out people's names using the ancient Hebrew characters, which are basically hieroglyphics, and trying to explain the significance of the letters, because there are 22 characters in the Hebrew alphabet, and they basically all express characteristics of God and his relationship with man. And it was a great way to link people up with who their Abba Father was, just explaining how their names were spelt out. But in biblical times, names were given to people and places because they either expressed what had happened there or they reflected a calling on that person. For example, Ebenezer is basically the Hebrew for Eben Ezer, which is stone of Ezer help. So it was a stone that commemorated and reminded the people that God had helped them in the past. And as far as names go, Jesus was named Yeshua. I know we call it Jesus in the English, but he was named Yeshua because Yeshua meant savior or redeemer in Hebrew. And Moses, or Moshe, as it is called in Hebrew, comes from the root word meaning to draw forth or to lead. And that's exactly what Moses did. He drew the people out of Egypt and led them into the promised, towards the promised land. He didn't make it himself. Or take the prophetess Deborah. Deborah actually means prophet, and it comes from a root word, debar, which means a word. Another word which is derived from debar, which I love to talk about. I just throw it into conversations with whoever I'm talking to because I love talking about Hebrew. But even non-believers get fascinated by the fact that a phrase we still use in English, abracadabra, is basically Hebrew words. Now, in Genesis 1, we read that God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters." So basically, God spoke or debarred things into existence. So if we look at the word abracadabra, it's basically the words a, bara, ka, debar, a. So bara is the word that comes back in Genesis, Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. Bara is to create. In fact, if you look up bara, it actually is more like the idea of choosing and selecting. If you think of somebody who works with wood, selecting a fine piece of wood that will be pared away and created into something useful, something that has purpose, transforming something that's just basically an old piece of wood and creating it into something amazing. Well, that's the idea of creating or healing. And early rabbis would have, when they prayed over people, they kind of thought, what did God say back at creation when he spoke things into existence? So they came up with this word, abara, which is I heal or I create. Ka is a prefix meaning like. Dabar, I speak. So abracadabra basically means I create or I heal as I speak. I transform as I speak. And over the years, people would have heard that, and showmen and magicians would have heard it, and they thought, that's a good word to use. It's got power in it. And over time, they started to incorporate the phrase into their performances, believing it held special mystical powers. So already this morning, you have heard three Hebrew words: abracadabra, bara, and dabar. Going back to names, some other interesting examples of name calling. The English name David is derived from the Hebrew word dod, meaning beloved. So if you want a new pet name for your beloved, Dodi is
Yoda.
Hebrew for my beloved. It's funny that in like, I'm gradually starting to see so many examples of where Hebrew and where the people, when Noah's sons went out and basically were told to populate all the earth, go forth and multiply. You can see Hebrew phrases have stuck. And even in Northern Ireland, a dodi is something which you give a child as a comforter. It's something that brings comfort to a child. It's like a dummy or a comforter in English or in American. So that's my beloved. And then the name Bethlehem or Beit Lechem is Hebrew for house of bread. And Yeshua, Jesus said, I am the bread of life. So appropriately, he was born in a place known as the house of bread. Now, a small country just northeast of Israel has hit the headlines this week. So I did a bit of research into the place we know today as Afghanistan and found it's actually referenced twice in the Old Testament. The first reference to Afghanistan is in the book of Joshua, where the promised land was portioned by lot by Eleazar the priest, Joshua, son of Nun, and the heads of the families of the tribes of Israel, as the Lord had commanded through Moses. Joshua 19, verses 24 to 30, describe the region allotted to Asher. And in verse 27, we read, now you don't need to remember these names, but I just want to make you become aware of this word. Their territory then turned eastward toward Beth Dagon, toward Zebulun and the valley of Iftahel, and went north to Beth Emek and Nail, passing Kabul on the left. So the town, which became known as Kabul, was originally part of the inheritance of the tribe of Asher, including the cities and their villages in the area. But who were the people of the tribe of Asher? Now, the name Asher means happy one or blessed, and it is derived from the Hebrew word ashar, meaning to advance or go forward with favor. I'll repeat that. The name Asher means happy one or blessed, and it's derived from the Hebrew word ashar, meaning to advance or go straight forward with favor. The tribe of Asher was renowned for its good food and prosperity, all of which came from the resources of that region. In fact, the olive tree became their tribal symbol, as the land was so fertile. It was said that even during the sabbatical or seventh year, when the land and the people rested, the tribe of Asher still had sufficient olives to provide oil for the whole of Israel. It's also interesting to note that on his deathbed, when Jacob was blessing his sons, he blessed his son Asher, saying, Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. That's found in Genesis 49, verse 20. Again, in Deuteronomy 33, verse 24, Moses said, now this is prophetic, Moses said concerning Asher, may Asher be the most blessed of sons, may he be the most favored among his brothers, and bathe his feet in olive oil. So in that prophecy from Moses, Asher would be the most blessed of sons, and Asher means blessed, and may he be the most favored among his brothers, and bathe his feet in olive oil. That's like bathing in ass's milk, I suppose, in today's terms, not that many people bathe in ass's milk. Anyway, the Asherites were also known for their wisdom. According to the Talmud, which is the early traditional teachings, Talmud basically means teachings, Asher was the very one who always sought to reconcile his brothers, especially when they argued over position. In another story in the Talmud, Asher was described as the example of a virtuous man, single-minded in his pursuit of good, entirely innocent of evil intent, always pursuing harmony among his brothers. So the tribe's people of Asher were known as the happy ones. Their land was fertile. Their people were peace-loving and known for their wisdom. It's hard to imagine how the city of Kabul that we now see on the news could have ever been described in these terms. How did events just go so badly wrong? Well, the first temple in Jerusalem was constructed during the reign of David's son Solomon and completed in 957 BC. 1 Kings 9 tells us, now when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the royal palace and had achieved all that he had desired to do, the Lord appeared to him a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and petition before me. I have consecrated this temple you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And for you, if you walk before me as your father David walked, now remember I said earlier that David means beloved, a beloved of the Lord. Your father David walked with integrity and uprightness, doing all I have commanded. So David basically walked out his calling, beloved by the Lord. And if you keep my statutes and ordinances like David, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I have promised your father David when I said, you will never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But if indeed you or your sons turn away from following me and do not keep the commandments and statutes I have set before you, and now this is important, if you go off to serve and worship other gods, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and I will banish from my presence this temple I have sanctified for my name. So what did Solomon do? 1 Kings 9 verse 10. Now, at the end of the 20 years during which Solomon built these two houses, the house of the Lord and the royal palace, King Solomon gave 20 towns in the land of Galilee to Hiram, king of Tyre, who had supplied him with cedar and cypress logs and gold for his every desire. So Hiram went out from Tyre to inspect the towns that Solomon had given them, but he was not pleased with them. Verse 13, "What are these towns you have given me, my brother?" asked Hiram, and he called them the land of Kabul, as they are called to this day. Hiram basically had sent the king 420 talents of gold. Now, if you're thinking, that might be about as much gold as you'd get in a jeweler's shop, 420 talents of gold is approximately 28 tons of gold, shipped over a space of 20 years. And the ships arrived basically every 3 years. Now, there are a few very obvious questions here that we need to address. Did Solomon honestly think it was okay to give away the most northeastern part of the promised land, including some of the towns originally allotted to the tribe of Asher? Who was Hiram, king of Tyre? Was he part of the kingdom or was he not part of the kingdom? And why did he choose to rename the region the land of Kabul? I am going to look at all of those questions, but first there is another interesting question that I just find intriguing. Where did all the gold come from? We're told that it came from Ophir, but where was Ophir? And there's also talk of King Solomon's mines and the legendary El Dorado have all become folklore over the years. But I think they're all wound up together in this story, as we're going to look at this morning. So just to set the scene a little, we've just read how King Hiram of Tyre supplied the gold for Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. 1 Kings 10 verse 11 documents how gold, sandalwood and precious stones were brought from Ophir over every 3 years. Now, Ophir is named in Genesis 10 verse 29 as the 11th son of Jokthan. I'm going to try and keep things simple. If you don't remember all of this, really all you need to remember is there was a direct family line, okay? Noah was the father of Ham and Shem. Well, Shem's great-great-great-grandsons were two brothers, and they were called Peleg and Jokthan. So basically, Peleg and Jokthan were fifth generation down from Shem. Those two names are important, as we shall shortly see. That's a lot of S's. So there was Noah, then Shem, then four more generations came Eber, and Eber had the two sons, Peleg and Jokthan. Jokthan is the one that we're really interested in, though Peleg does come in a bit later in the story. Jokthan had 11 sons, one of whom was called Sheba and another was called Ophir. There were two daughters, obviously making 13 children. Genesis 10 concludes with these words: "These are the sons of Shem by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their nations. These are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies in their nations, and from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood." I know we generally shy away from genealogies, but they're recorded there for a purpose, because sometimes you just need them to try and put things into perspective. So, the land of Ophir. There has been some debate over the location of Ophir. It was a land, we know, rich in gold, sandalwood, and precious gems. Some have suggested that Ophir and his clan may have settled in Sumatra. Others have suggested India, but I came across some rather compelling evidence that Ophir may have actually been the Philippines. As we've noted already, Jock Than had 11 sons, but he also had two daughters, making 13, 10 of whom, we are told, settled towards the east, and three of them, Ophir, Sheba, and Havilah, settled in a place described as the Islands of the Sea. We also know they went westwards, so it's highly unlikely that Ophir could have been India. Now, we know that they settled in a place described as the Islands of the Sea. The Philippines is a group of some 7,640 islands. That's 7640. And it is a place close to my heart, having been there twice to work on a water project in 92 with OMF International and then in 2003 with Open Doors. Both trips were spent on the island of Mindanao, which is the second largest island just south of Luzon. On both occasions, I flew into Cagayan de Oro Airport, and that is actually an ancient name meaning River of Gold. Nearby was the island of Mindoro, which comes from the Spanish Mina de Oro, meaning gold mine, and believed by many to be a reference to the legendary El Dorado and King Solomon's mine. There is a Spanish archive held in Spain covering, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. I struggle enough with Hebrew words. Spanish archive covering the period 1519 to 1522, which logs the voyage of Ferdinand Magellan and references Ophir as many islands in front of China towards the sea, which, if you look at a map, is a fairly accurate description of the Philippines. Again, looking at a map of the islands, many of the major mountains and volcanoes still bear Hebrew names. There's Mount Pulag, which is a variant of Peleg, meaning dazzling light. And you may remember from Genesis 10 that Peleg was the brother of Jochum. So Peleg was Ophir's uncle, as Peleg and Jochthan were brothers. At the foot of Mount Pulag is a cave known as the Cabayan Cave, and Chabaya is Hebrew for Yahweh has hidden. Archaeologists have actually discovered the remains of fire mummies, similar to ones found in Egyptian caves. So it's fascinating. Then Mount Pinatubo is derived from the Hebrew words pina, meaning God raises, and tubo, his goodness. Banaya comes from bana, which is the Hebrew verb to build, and ya, an abbreviation of Yahweh. So Banaya means Yahweh builds. Finally, Mayon is the name of a volcano, and Mayan is Hebrew for a spring of water. Another wee bit of evidence. The logbook also contains accounts by a man called Antonio Pigafetta, who traveled with the explorer Ferdinand Magellan, and he speaks of encounters with the native Filipinos. Now, if you think about it, when Magellan discovered the Philippines, he basically was an explorer. He discovered a land which hadn't been populated by the Spanish because he was the first one to find it. And when they asked them who their god was, the natives clasped their hands, lifted their faces to the sky and called their god Abba, which I just think is fascinating. Another little nugget which hadn't clicked with me before was the reference to Solomon's fascination with the Queen of Sheba, Ophir. Ophir, Sheba, and Havilah were Jokthan's three children who headed east together. So it would appear that the gold for Solomon's temple was collected by King Hiram from Ophir and Sheba. It nearly seems that King Hiram was going around all of the different tribes, gathering in stuff and bringing it back to Jerusalem. In fact, I've always wondered about the Queen of Sheba. I thought it was a bit strange the way suddenly she flits in on the scene in 1 Kings chapter 10. Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with difficult questions. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. And he answered the questions, and basically the Queen of Sheba gave him 120 talents of gold. Now, Queen of Sheba, Sheba and Ophir were brothers. So it nearly seems like Hiram was going around gathering in all these things, baboons, colourful stones, all of these things, bringing them back. And she just kind of thought, I'm not going to give up my money until I see what it's being spent on. So the Queen of Sheba actually came and visited Solomon and questioned him and was so satisfied with what was happening there with the temple that she gave 120 nuggets of gold. But anyway, the ships arrived every 3 years containing this gold, silver, baboons and peacocks. So the ships made, as I say, have gathered the finest produce from the families of the clans who headed westwards as well as eastwards. I will have to get back to the main story of Solomon, Hiram and the land of Kabul, as I love to go off on moose trails, but I just thought it's fascinating that evidence is still there that we can date back. Oh, by the way, the scented sandalwood that is spoken of still exists in the Philippines.
Yeah.
So King Hiram sent ships to gather in all the gold and silver, and he supplied the finest cedar from the Lebanon over a 20-year period. And King Solomon gave him the 20 towns lying in a narrow mountainous area along the northeastern border of Israel. Hiram was a Phoenician king. He was quite a businessman. In fact, in today's terms, we might refer to him as a shipping magnate, and he certainly understood the logistics of trade and transportation. If you Google Hiram, you will find that he was responsible for developing two seaports in Tyre, and he connected them with a canal which ran through the city. He was also responsible for erecting two new temples to Melkart and Astarte, not to be confused with the Ashtaroth goddess, but basically two new temples were erected under Hiram. Now, you may not be familiar with these two names. I wasn't until I started researching them, but Melkart was a major deity in the Phoenician pantheon of gods. And in fact, Melkart was later equated with the Greek god Hercules. Melkart was known as Baal-Sur, or Lord of Tyre. He was also known as son of Baal and lord of the underworld. Melkart was depicted in statue form as a bearded man wearing only a round hat and a loincloth, and he was associated with fertility and the seasons and harvests, along with the goddess Astarte. Now, Melkart was often shown holding a lotus flower, which symbolized life, and an axe as a symbol of death. Reading how King Solomon rewarded all of Hiram's lavish input for 20 years, sending ships round all around the globe, gathering in gold baboons, like, would you want to be on a boat with a baboon? You might be tempted to feel sympathy for Hiram, but the promised land was special because land was an inheritance and Yahweh was God of Israel. This thin section of land was contained within the section of land that had been allotted to Asher, the happy, blessed, favoured ones. The tribe of Asher were known, as I've said, to be wise, reconciliatory people with fertile land growing with olives. But some of their cities were given to a foreign Phoenician king who worshipped Melkart, king of the underworld. And to say that Hiram was a little underwhelmed or disappointed to inherit them would be an understatement. We don't know what Kabul's original name had been, but it appears in 1 Kings 9, verse 13, that Hiram challenged Solomon with the words, "What kind of towns are these you have given me, my brother?" And he called then the area Kabul. So it appears that it wasn't known as Kabul up until now. It definitely says there, he called then that area Kabul. And do you know what Kabul means? Kabul is Hebrew for worthless, a name they have to this day. Worthless. The root of Kabul is the word kebel, and kebel is a fetter. It means to be bound and fettered. So a prime portion of land which had been dedicated to Yahweh, given by Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, a portion of land that sits at the crossroads at the centre of the earth of trading routes, and a slither of land to the northeast of that special land was given away, handed over to a foreign king who would regard it as worthless, a king who worshipped the Lord of the Underworld. The words of 1 Kings 9 had obviously fallen on deaf ears, and they would come back to haunt Solomon. If you go off to serve and worship other gods, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them. Solomon had abandoned part of the kingdom, and more specifically the tribe of Asher, by handing over their land and people to the mercy of a foreign king who worshipped foreign gods. I've called this morning the power of a calling, the curse of a name. It had all begun so well, and was this how the story would end? The land of Asher, the happy, blessed, favoured ones, the people who reconciled, now cursed as worthless, fettered, bound. Names can stick, names can bind, but while there is still life and breath, it is not the end. Way, way back in the beginning, we were created in the image of God. Genesis 1 verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God's people, the tribe of Asher, was called to be happy, blessed, highly favoured. And then through a twist of fate, an unwise business deal between Solomon and Hiram, an entire city plus 19 other cities were called worthless, and they forgot their identity, their inheritance, their hope, and their destiny. I'm not making a political point about Israel's ownership of the land, for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And it's not about the rights and wrongs of political powers and governments, whether soldiers should have been sent into Afghanistan. I'm not trying to point score, just offer a little bit of insight into where we are right now. For we can learn important lessons from Kabul. From the soldiers caught up in the fighting to the innocent children orphaned and abandoned, worthless is just a place that some are fortunate enough to pass through, while others can settle there or even end their days there, and it becomes their identity and resting place. But this is about the power of a calling, not the curse of a place name. Yes, we are standing at a point in history, a very significant point where we can see the history of a nation unfolding before our eyes. Maybe unravelling would be a better word. And if it weren't for the events of this past week being pulled to centre stage in world events, I might not have researched the history of Kabul. But this is about the power of a calling to be reconciled with Papa God, a calling to live in right relationship with Abba Father, a calling to be blessed, highly favoured. The calling is dynamic. The calling is like a bias drawing us back to the Father God in whose image we were created, to partner with God and be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation belonging to God. Maybe you are thinking that's all very well, but who am I? I'm not a member of the tribe of Asher. No one has ever spoken about blessings over me. Well, hear these words from Psalm 139, verses 7 to 18. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your books were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. So even if you don't think you're of the tribe of Asher. To everyone created in the image of God, and that most definitely includes you, your identity is intricately bound up in the words of these verses. And your Heavenly Father, who formed you in your mother's womb, has more thoughts and hopes and dreams for your life than the sand on the seashore. There is a power in this calling, way more powerful than any curse or situation. And next week, Sharon will continue this truth as she looks deeper at our identity and calling. Amen.